Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Blog Talk Radio, and we will be talking about issues dealing with UFOs today.
We have tackled many strange stories on 60 Minutes, but perhaps none like this. It's the story of the U.S. government's grudging acknowledgement of unidentified aerial phenomena, UAP, more commonly known as UFOs. After decades of public denial, the Pentagon now admits there's something out there, and the U.S. Senate wants to know what it is. The Intelligence Committee has ordered the Director of National Intelligence and the Secretary of Defense to deliver a report on the mysterious sightings by next month.
Wow.
The story will continue in a moment.
Yeah, we will continue that story from 60 Minutes down the road, but I just wanted to play that to indicate that the subject is getting a lot of attention now. Now they talk about UAPs, unidentified aerial projections, unidentified flying objects, whatever. So we want to talk about that. But first, I want to invite Gillian, how are you today?
I'm very well, thank you, Russell. Nice to hear you.
I appreciate you being here today. What I want to really focus on, since the subject matter is coming to the fore, is that a lot of people are beginning to really look at this now that the UFO subject is being put out there by the Pentagon. Have you seen any of that at all?
No, I haven't. I haven't. I mean, that information with the government has been there for years. It's not something new. It's always been there. I don't know why they need a month to put a report together, because they've been building their report in a major way, at least since World War II. Even when John Kennedy tried to get the Secret Service people, the whatever they're called, whichever one it is, to disclose to him about what they knew about the UFOs, they said, sorry, it was only for, you know, people who need to know, and the president didn't need to know because he needed deniability. So even the president of the United States does not get to be told everything that they, predominantly, I would think, the naval intelligence or the Pentagon, one of those two areas, actually know. But they know everything there is to know about it. There are no secrets, especially with naval intelligence. So I don't know why they need, as I say, a month to put a report together, because they should be able to print it out at the drop of a hat. So that's kind of nonsense.
Well, did you remember, let's go back a bit then, since you're talking about that, when there was that crash in 1947 at Roswell, George Green, he was on top of that all the time. Let's talk about that. What happened?
Well, I don't know, because I wasn't there. I only know what everybody else knows, what one can read about, that an alien ship of some kind crashed and was recognized as being alien material by the Air Force officers in charge of the when they take all the pieces, when they gather it all up, right? That's right. And he took it away. But there was more than one crash, because one of the crashes, they did get a whole UFO, which they had in Andrews Air Force Base. And that was the one that George, meaning George Green, that was the one that George was most involved in, because at the time that they were working on it, he himself was in the Air Force and stationed at Andrews Air Force Base, where he actually saw the spaceship. And his friend on the campus there was also in the Air Force, and he was the Air Force photographer. And George persuaded him to show him the photographs from the crash site of all the vehicle, etc. And there was a photograph of the two dead aliens as well, which George used to say that really impressed him more than the UFO with the two dead aliens. And so that was soon after it was a while after Roswell. I'm trying to think when that would have been. 59 or 1960, somewhere in there, when George actually got involved because of Andrews.
Okay. Yeah, I remember he said that story. So you, when we started the program, you indicated that this subject matter has been in the air for many, 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 many decades, probably centuries. But lately,
yes,
it seems to be coming to the fore, and I wanted to address something specifically, talk about underground bases. I believe someone had said that there are many, 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 many hundreds, thousands of underground bases all across the world. And we talked about one in New Mexico, Dorsey. What was that?
Dulce. Yes, Dulce.
Okay. Let's talk about that, the possibility that there are many cities underground, many people there working, and many aliens, so-called, will occupy those areas, especially Dorsey. Let's talk about that.
Well, the only one, I'm sure there are hundreds of them. I know there's a lady out there, I've forgotten her name, but she has specialized in underwater photography, in actually photographing underwater cities that are occupied by the aliens. And my thought about that is that a lot of those underwater cities are probably occupied by the Anunnaki, because the Anunnaki are great submariners. That's they come from a water planet. The crossing planet is very covered with water, a lot of water, and they do a lot of things underwater. So I'm thinking that several of the cities that she has photographed, including, I believe she said, one in San Diego Bay, in that big bay area. But when it comes to the Dulce base, and this one I do happen to know about, Grays. And I am not entirely sure, and I never have been entirely sure, who these Grays, so-called Grays, are. I don't remember seeing anywhere or anybody ever saying where they're supposed to be from or who they're supposed to be. But I have my own ideas about it, because the ones we refer to as the Grays are a human-like species that have been responsible for most of the human abductions since World War II, and for a lot longer than that, for thousands of years almost, they have been experimenting with Earth humans. I want to say for the last 4,000 years, or 3,000 or 4,000 years, they've been experimenting with crossbreeding with Earth humans to try and prolong their own stay on this planet, or to create bodies which can live a long time. And because of that, I have this is entirely conjecture on my part. I don't know if it's true or not. It's just an idea I have. But when the Anunnaki left this planet approximately 4,000 years ago, several hundred of them stayed behind. They didn't want to leave Earth, and they stayed behind. And they made underground bases for themselves, the first one being under Lake Titicaca in Peru. And they made other places where they could stay and continue to live on this planet. And they over the last 2,000-3,000 years, have been deteriorating physically a great deal. And their normal very, very, very long life span has been getting shorter and shorter. So in more recent human history, they have been, because they, even previously, they were marrying Earth women. So I think they have more recently been doing serious experimentation with Earth humans to try and develop a perfect crossbreed between the two, which would have the longevity of the Anunnaki, but be entirely Earth-human in the ability to live on this planet. And what they're looking for is to do with gravity. more than anything else, it's not about looks or appearance, it's about gravity, that the Anunnaki live on a planet that's about the same gravity as the moon, about 1/6 of Earth's gravity. So for them to live on this planet with our gravity, it's much more difficult. There are many, many problems for the Anunnaki when they're actually on this planet. Lung diseases, broken bones, and heart problems lead the way. And I think, I could be quite wrong about this, but I think that those in the Dulce bases that we now call the Greys because of their appearance may well be the remnants of those offshoot of the Anunnaki race who never left this planet. That's just my supposition. And I'm saying that because when I was younger, a lot younger, around 19 years of age, I spent about 2 years on many nights going out of body and working at that Dulce base throughout the night, helping people who were there. I remember doing it very distinctly, and I could describe what the base looks like. It's like a it's built like a underground, like long hallways of blocks of built of concrete blocks, and there are long rooms with patients, with people in, like an old fire, an old style hospital, like you would see a hospital 50, 60 years ago. Long, long hallways, iron beds, people in them. And I used to go out of body and help there at night. So I'm pretty, I know what it looked like. And I do not think, I've questioned this about myself many, many times. I do not believe that if it had been a bad place to be working, in other words, if it had been really evil stuff that was going on, I don't think I would have gone. Instinct would have kept me away from it because I was always a clairvoyant. I could always see right from wrong. So I doubt very much if I would have gone there if I hadn't thought that the people who were there were not necessarily bad, good, doing something good, but not necessarily doing something bad either. And so I really, that's all I know about the Dulce base, and it's the only underground base that I really know anything at all about.
All right. Well, let me ask you something. Let me play this first, this clip of an abductee, and I'll ask you why the continuation of abductions.
Was for me, the conscious memories that I had was in the middle of the night, I woke up very conscious, walked over to my living room, saw something in the room, felt the white light, felt the paralysis, and then I fell asleep. Several hours later, I woke up and had these intense emotions associated with the experience that just I couldn't fathom. Like, why was I so scared? Why was I terrified? What was...
You had a bad dream.
That's what I thought. That's what I wanted to believe. Mm-hmm. That's what I wanted to believe for years. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what most people want to believe.
So why the abductions continuously for many... Okay, go ahead.
Okay. First of all, everyone, including myself, when we are young and we are taken and tested, right, by the extraterrestrials, whichever group it is that's got us as an abductee, it's a frightening experience because it's entirely alien to us. And here's something. I don't think that the extraterrestrials ever really understood how emotionally stressful it is to an Earth human to find themselves in that situation and have an emotional body response to it. Not that most of them can actually remember what happened to them until, of course, they do their hypnosis and things that they do. Most of us cannot remember the detail of what happens, but the body remembers, and the body remembers it as a very unpleasant experience. And it's much the same as if you go to a hospital and they run a barrage of tests on you. And you didn't know what to expect from those tests. For instance, the first time they put you in an MRI machine and it's suddenly starts banging really loud in your head. You know, you can hear the noise and you don't know what's happening, right? So that, I think, is what triggers the fear, because there's nothing actually fearful happening. You're just being tested. And the testing and the continuation of it, the same families. Now, you may remember, Russell, when we talked a week or so ago, I mentioned to you that since the Anunnaki did the original genetic engineering on the hominid species on the planet, and that these people were the core of the Sumerian group in the Middle East, were fundamentally the center core of what became known as the Jewish people, or the Hebrews, right? These were the original genetically altered group. And they numbered, the first grouping was only seven people, only seven, right? And then that was multiplied after they were given the ability to breed among themselves. But there was a core group of just a few hundred, let's say maybe 1,000, that represented 500 families, 500 couples. And I'm just making that number up because I don't know the number, but let's just say we ended up with 1,000 genetically altered humans. And those were the ones that were originally in that Middle East area, the Eden, and they were the ones that were taught, agriculture, engineering, metalwork, all the things that they were taught how to do. That core group, the Anunnaki, have kept a genetic record of ever since. There is a genealogy for those people ever since, like a giant, giant family tree. And the abductees, which now number in the tens of thousands worldwide, right? They are all direct descendants through those original family tree. It's the same bloodline that is taken over and over again, right down through the last 4,000 years, 5,000 years. The same. So this is why it's the same people, and why it's often, you know, a father is taken and then his son is taken, like in that communion story that they made a film of, that book Communion, that they made a film of. That describes very well the process that goes on. In fact, if anybody hasn't seen that movie, it's still out there. I think it's on some of the television channels now. It's called Communion, and it really does, I'm not saying it's 100% correct because it's one person's experience, but as a generalization of the experiences that many people have, that movie gives you a really good insight into it. And of course, the end result is that you find out down the line there's nothing to be afraid of, that what is being done both for your benefit and for the extraterrestrials' benefit. It's not a bad thing, but it's true for many, many people. It is a frightening experience.
Okay, but have you seen the motion picture, The Fourth Kind, Communion, yet, by Whitley Strieber is a great one. But The Fourth Kind,
yes.
Have you seen that? Huh?
No.
You haven't seen that? Yeah.
No.
When you get a chance, I want you to watch that. And that was taken in Nome, Alaska. The incident is supposed to be true. And it goes way back a couple, three, 4, 5 years ago. But when you get a chance, watch that. But anyway, I want to step it up and talk about a lot of people are being abducted and taken to Antarctica. Can we talk about that? Because you just finished a book, and that was one of the books that
right.
I read was Dr. Michael Sellar, and he talked about
yes.
Antarctica's hidden history. Let's talk about that for a minute.
Yes. Good. That is one of the most informative. It's one book out of a trilogy. There are three books for the whole series. The one I enjoyed the best was Hidden History. And it's probably one of the best books I've read in the last 20 years. It's a most excellent book because it is so well documented. You can really trust that this writer, Dr. Michael Sala, has done his research and has provided documentary evidence for most of what he is saying in the book. And it's all about what's going on under Antarctica. What got me interested, first of all, I've always loved Antarctica because I remember it before it was covered with snow and ice, and it's a beautiful, beautiful continent. So I've always been interested, and I got particularly interested 2 or 3 years ago when I read in the news that all these top people, including the Pope and the Queen and the President and all these people, were going to the South Pole. And ever since Captain Byrd's flyover of the North Pole, I've been interested. So I got the book by Michael Sala, and I've read it a couple of times. And what I discovered from his book was the whole history that's gone on since World War II, when the Germans apparently or allegedly prolonged the war an extra 2 years, even though they knew they were beaten and would have to give in the end. They extended it to give themselves time to ship their industry down to Antarctica. Some extraterrestrials, and one of the groups they were involved with was the Pleiadians. They had a secret society in Germany called the Vril Society, which existed before World War II. And there was a psychic lady called Maria Orsic, who was getting information about rockets, engineering information about rockets from the Pleiadians, from some extraterrestrial Pleiadians that had contacted her. She was passing this on to the members of the Vril Society, who were scientists and researchers and members of the Nazi Party. And they, in turn, started sharing that information with the Nazi high command. And at one point, Hitler decided that he wanted to make two groups, the Vril group having one set of knowledge and the high command having another. So he divided it into two. And then he used the information he was getting from the extraterrestrials to build his V rockets, which, of course, he used to devastate most of England right at the time in World War II. So when World War II was drawing to a close, he, using the information he had from the extraterrestrials on how to get underwater into the great caverns under Antarctica, he built giant submarines, loaded huge factories in, and took at one point several, I believe, 2,000 or 3,000 of his slave workers, European slave workers, and shipped them all down to Antarctica, where he has, according to this evidence in these books, continued to operate today. Not Hitler personally, I believe he died at some point, but the Nazi Party, the Third Reich, which is now the Fourth Reich, has continued to advance and develop its military industrial base under Antarctica ever since World War II, and continues to operate there today, so that it is now believed that the sightings of the UFOs, which occurred over Washington a few years, some years ago, those were from that German base, and no action was ever taken because it was like the Fourth Reich saying to America, you know, there's nothing, you can't touch us because we have this technology, we have this aircraft, and we can do as we like, and we can come into your prohibited airspace, and your planes can't even catch us. And so that really has laid the tenor of the relationship between the United States and the underground German operation since World War II. And as I said, all this that I'm saying is very well documented with presidentially signed documents and information. But there is also a great deal in Dr. Sala's books that is not hearsay, but reporting. Reporting of whistleblowers who were involved themselves with the U.S. military and who served in the Space Command, which the U.S. government has had for many years now, 25 years or so, they've had ships in the Space Command. Through it's an offshoot of, I believe I'm right in saying, not our Air Force. I think it's under the control of our Navy. I think the ships are spaceships, and I think they can come under the U.S. Naval Command, but they're a space fleet, and they patrol space, and so they are ships that are also using the same technology that the Germans brought out of Antarctica, which got into our aerospace industry when, after World War II, some of the Germans did not go to Antarctica. They came in with the groups that we bought in. They were still Nazis. They were still with the Fourth Reich, but they came in with the ones that came to America supposedly to be helpful to America. And they became involved with the Martin Lockheed Corporation in the aerospace, in the development of rocketry. And then from there, they're now taken over by Boeing. Boeing bought over Martin Lockheed fairly recently. So the Germans under the Antarctic are now involved directly with our industrial military complex here on the mainland. Now, besides them, they are they are believed to be having and still taking thousands of humans for slave labor to work under the Antarctic in the factories there and to be shipped off the planet to work for them on Mars, where they have other bases, and on the moon, where we have a base as well. And we also have a base on Mars at this present time. Also at the same time under the Antarctic are the psychic lady Maria Orsic, who was with the Pleiadians, and they have their own supposedly now separate group that with the Germans, alongside the Germans, still operating under the Antarctic. And okay, it's the Pleiadian ships that everybody knows about. The right. little round spaceships, those are the Pleiadian ships.
Right.
That's about everything I know.
Well, you covered a lot of territory, because that flyover that happened with those spaceships, if you will, quote unquote, that was around 1952, and that's documented. You can always go back in history and look for all that document material that has been already out there in terms of the Washington Post and all of that. But here, let me play this clip to talk about other people who have been doing research about the underground bases in Antarctica.
All the resources and manpower of the U.S. military industrial complex were hence made available for a significant expansion of the German space program, whereby it could become an interplanetary colonial power capable of deploying significant military resources outside of our solar system in support of their extraterrestrial allies. In addition to the Antarctica revelations of William Tompkins, we also have the testimony of Corey Good, who says he served in the U.S. Navy's secret space program, Solar Warden. His claims of serving in Solar Warden and having extensive contact with multiple groups of extraterrestrials were extensively examined in the first volume of this secret space program series. The connection of the pre-Adamites to different historical epochs in our solar system and the role of Antarctica as a refuge for escaping Martians and the inhabitants of a former super-Earth from the asteroid belt is laid out and scrutinized in Chapter 13. The connection between Antarctica and the fallen angels described in the Book of Enoch ensues and is analyzed in Chapter 14. It will be shown how this apocryphal book points to Antarctica as the location of their imprisonment. Most incredible is Good's claim that some of these pre-Adamites are still alive in stasis chambers and that their bloodline descendants want to not only awaken them, but also restore them to their previous positions of authority. If left undisturbed, this nexus of domination and slavery will spread like a virus over the rest of the planet with predictable results. It's up to all that cherish human freedom and creativity to rise up, end this vile practice, and expose the global elite that secretly enable it. Only full disclosure of Antarctica's suppressed history and its current events will ensure that all humanity benefits from the advanced technologies that have been secretly developed and deployed there. Disclosure will furthermore help prepare humanity for major geological events that lie ahead, as West Antarctica's ice shelves continue to melt due to increased volcanic activity. A global transformation awaits us if we have the courage to embrace the truth about what was and is occurring now in Antarctica.
Now, you talked about the fact that President Biden, President Obama and the Pope and Putin and even Buzz Aldrin and some others took trips to Antarctica to see what was going on just a few years ago. How come when you mention that most people don't have that information? Do you have a clue about how that's being held back from the people, that disclosure?
No, I'm sorry, I missed something there. My phone just cut out a moment. Do you mind repeating the question for me?
Okay, here's a question. He talked about Antarctica and that there's really a lot of slaves been all working down as they are on the moon and especially on Mars as we speak, hundreds of thousands of people. And I'm saying to you, when Putin and Barack Obama, Biden, and Buzz Aldrin and other people have gone to Antarctica, most people don't have that history. Why? Since it's already documented that they went to Antarctica a couple of years ago.
Yes. Why don't people know that they went there? Is that
right.
What you're saying?
Right.
Well, I don't know, because it was in all the newspapers and on the news. You know, I read about it in a newspaper.
Well, I did too, yeah.
So I guess people just don't read the news.
Don't believe what they read?
Yes, I mean, it was on the television, and it was on the news.
It was.
I guess the information is there for people who want it. But, you know, I think that's true for most information, isn't it?
I guess so.
If it's not something that doesn't directly interest us, we don't bother to look it up.
That's true. And then William Tompkins, I just want to take it back because you mentioned the Navy. William Tompkins, who just recently left us at 94 years of old age, he has a book called Selected by Extraterrestrials. And have you read any of his books, or have you been in contact with some of the things that he did before, or talked about before he left?
I'm sorry, what was his name again?
William Tompkins.
Tompkins, yes.
Right.
No, you mentioned this to me before. The only thing I know about him is what I read in Dr. Sala's books.
Oh.
In these Antarctica books, he writes extensively about Tompkins and Good, Corey, is it?
Corey Good,
And their experience, Corey
and
Good.
David Wilcox.
And all their experiences, and particularly Tompkins' very reliable history, because he worked for the government, and so his own personal history is very well documented.
I don't think there's
any reason to disbelieve him.
I'm more inclined to believe him. The book, his latest book is Selected by Extraterrestrials, My Life in the Top Secret World of UFOs, Think Tanks, and Nordic Secretaries. So he was around that from 1942 up until his passing a year ago or something like that. When George was on the stump traveling all over the world. He talked about Groom's Lake and S4 and Area 51. What information would you pass on to those individuals who were not present at the time and didn't hear George? What information would you pass on to them about Area 51, Groom's Lake, S4? Here's a clip first.
Well,
it's called Area 51 or Dreamland. It's not on any map, but Nevada officially named the road leading to it Extraterrestrial Highway. It is about 100 miles north-northeast of Las Vegas and about as hard to get at as a Megabucks jackpot. Because even though every exotic jet flying today designed to fight an apocalyptic World War III was tested here, even though news of Area 51 is readily available on the internet, the Pentagon refuses to admit it exists.
Don't know for sure what made the ground move around 7 o'clock this morning, but seismologists say it was not an earthquake.
The pre-dawn rumbling that has confused millions of Southern Californians was the sound of their tax dollars flying by. NBC News has learned the sonic booms are coming from top-secret reconnaissance planes with revolutionary engines, codenamed Aurora. They look something like this. They have been tracked 5 times since last summer crossing the Los Angeles Basin. Jim Morey, a Caltech seismologist, says the plane's sonic booms trigger his instruments every time.
When we see one, it seems like we see two of them coming in together, so it seems like two aircraft flying together.
Defense sources say the secret planes replaced the vaunted SR-71 Blackbird, retired in 1990. NBC News has been told the aircraft can fly at almost 5,000 miles an hour.
What did George say about Area 51 or S4 or Groom's Lake? Did he have any comments on those?
I don't remember what George said about Area 51. I honestly don't. I remember him telling me not to even say, oh, you want to go there, because they'd moved everything from there to Montana. So I don't know if that was true or not. But this is several years ago. He made that comment to me. But Area 51 itself was where they kept most of their extraterrestrial experimentation and the engineering, the information they got from it. And they made the only thing I really, really know is that a friend of mine, his name was Chris, won't give you his last name because he might still be in trouble for telling me, but his college chum and he were both science bots, you know, really borderline out-of-the-box thinking young geniuses. And they were offered to work for the government, right? Well, Chris didn't want to do it. He wanted to keep doing his own thing. But his friend took it. Now, this is many years ago. I'm thinking maybe 35 years ago. And the young man was offered a job for $60,000 a year, which was a lot of money then, and plus a grant, a lump sum grant for his research. So he took it, he accepted it, and he went to work for the government, and this work was at Area 51, and he had to go and live there, and he lived in Area 51, and he had a nice two-bedroom apartment, and Chris was allowed in to go and visit him. He got a special pass. And he went 2 or 3 times over the first year or two to visit with his friend, and exchanging science ideas between them, and nothing extraordinary, you know. But then one day, Chris went to visit his friend. And when he got to the gate and asked for him, they said, there's no person with that name here. So he said, yes, he lives over there in one of those bunks. No, there's nobody there. Well, Chris made such a fuss. Eventually, the guards took him in and took him to the house he pointed out, and it was completely empty. It looked as if it had never been lived in. There was nothing in there, absolutely nothing. And his friend was never heard from again. And when he was telling me about it, Chris said, I think what happened was that he was working on such advanced military material, killing material, and he wasn't a killing sort of person. He was interested in the science of the flight, the, you know, whatever they were doing, the flying, the UFOs and things. But then when it came to the weaponry, he said, no, I don't want to work on machines to kill people. And I quit. I give my notice in. And he was never heard from again. Not his family, nobody. So definitely Area 51 and any of those secret government places, you can guarantee that your best and safest thing in life, is, if you want to stay alive, is to have nothing to do with them, because they are never going to tell you their secrets. They are never going to share them with the public, because that means the world gets to know. And the last thing any government wants the world to know is what secret weapons they've got stashed away. And when you go digging too deep and inquiring about it, you're just going to get yourself, well, you'll end up in jail one way or another, and they throw away the key. So, you know, especially since now we have it, the Patriot Act, you're best not to even think about these things, let alone discuss them.
That was the thinking for 40 years for many people. However, you had George Green, you had Linda Mutant Howe, you had Colonel Wendell Stevens. I mean, I don't want to go through all the names. Corey Good, David Wilcock. All those people have been researching this for many, many years, for the last 10, 20,
right.
30, 40, 50 that, years, right? And they
that,
are still...
That's true.
And they weren't put upon, so to speak. They weren't treated, they weren't in harm's way with the men in black, right?
I don't know that that's true. It depends on what they knew. If they knew things, if you can bet your bottom dollar that if it went into print, the government was allowing it to go into print.
Oh, I see.
Look,
okay.
George had documents that a friend of his sent to him, and this gentleman worked for the government. He has died now, so it doesn't matter. He died a couple of years ago, but he sent George documents, and he sent them to two other friends in different parts of the world, and he said, if ever I die unexpectedly, you have these documents. In other words, he was in fear of his life all the time, and he had let the powers that be know, I have these documents that will go public if anything happens to me. And that's a fairly common way that these people protect themselves. They have some information which is so above top secret that they know their lives are at risk if they even whisper it to their partner in bed, right? And yet they try to protect themselves by telling somebody else what this information is and getting them to keep it secret so that if anything happens to them, the beans will come out. It's the only way they have to protect themselves. And this is what they do. And don't think that even somebody as innocuous as George, because George was never talking about top information, not top secret information. He was not like these who are spilling the beans on a lot of secret stuff. George was very seldom doing anything that might be constituted a national threat. Yet even he had instructed me when we were first together over in Idaho, if anybody comes to the door asking for me, Joe, tell them that I don't live here and you don't know who I am.
I see.
These people really do live in fear of their lives.
Right.
Now, George
was
never in fear of anything, but George used to laugh about it. He said, I don't worry about it, Jill. They'll never come after me because they think I know a lot more than I do. And they wouldn't want me telling it.
Oh, I see. Okay. There was another gentleman who passed not too long ago, Philip Corso. Did you know anything about Colonel Philip Corso?
No, I read about him, but I don't know anything about him personally. I don't know him.
Yeah, he just passed, and he has said, let me play this just for a second.
But hidden beneath everything I did at the center of a double life I led that no one knew about, and buried deep inside my job at the Pentagon was a single file cabinet that I had inherited because of my intelligence background. That file held the Army's deepest and most closely guarded secret, the Roswell files. The cache of debris and information an Army retrieval team from the 509th Army Airfield pulled out of the wreckage of a flying disc that had crashed outside the town of Roswell in the New Mexico desert in the early morning darkness during the first week of July, 1947. The Roswell file was the legacy of what happened in the hours and days after the crash when the official government cover-up was put into place. As the military tried to figure out what it was that had crashed, where it had come from, and what its inhabitants' intentions were, a covert group was assembled under the leadership of the Director of Intelligence, Admiral Roscoe Hillencutter, to investigate the nature of the flying discs and collect all information about encounters with these phenomena while at the same time publicly and officially discounting the existence of all flying saucers.
Now, this he has gone now, but he left a book called The Day After Roswell. It's worth reading that he says that he was in charge. Yes. Did you ever read that or come across it?
I actually believe there's a copy here. I think I have a copy of that book.
But
it must be a long, long time since I read it because I don't remember a lot of it. It must be years since I read it. I mean, it's a fairly old book.
It is. But there are, for the people who want to get it, obviously you can go to nohoax.net. And a lot of books that we are talking about are there, including the three books that you wrote. So that's a good site to go to, nohoax.net. So listen, how do you, I guess, talk about, we talked about the spaceships that went over the Capitol in 1952. A number of them, and they said, you can't shut us down, you can't keep us quiet, we are still operating. What would you say to the average person who may not just fathom all of this? How would you describe this whole thing that we're talking about? Do you think that the Disclosure Project, Dr. Greer. Do you think, he's pressing ahead to have all of this uncovered. Obviously, he's been working since 1993 to have all these things disclosed. Let's talk about Dr. Greer. What role do you think he's playing in getting this stuff?
I don't know Dr. Greer. George knew Dr. Greer. What I know of him, I highly respect. I think he's a great researcher and he's doing a really good job. And I personally do think that all these things should be made public. And for a very obvious reason, that we have a massive confusion between what is true extraterrestrial entity action, meaning genuine extraterrestrials interacting with our planet in whatever agenda they have, and what's going on because of the governments of the Earth. There's one sentence in Dr. Sala's books that stuck in my mind because I thought it was well worth repeating. He says at one point that Germany, World War II, Germany lost the battle but won the war. And that is true. If you look at history since World War II, all of it, European history and American history, British history, if you look at what happens and you take into account what's going on in Antarctica, then that is absolutely true. Germany lost the battle, but they won the war because they are now running everything globally, right? they are the seat, politically speaking, of the really bad guys, I think. So that, I think, needs clarifying. Which aspects of this whole UFO thing are to do with Germans and the Fourth Reich and what's gone on politically on this planet since World War II, and what has gone on with the extraterrestrials? And I am particularly concerned about what's gone on with the Pleiadian group, because they are the single largest group interacting with this planet and always have been. The Pleiadians, because they're fairly close to us, cosmically speaking, and because the Anunnaki came out of the Pleiadian system, they have had a long and laid-back, easy connection, you might say, with this planet, with the Earth. So I'm very concerned, what is their current agenda, and why have they been and still are closely connected with the Germans? It's no use telling me, well, we're two separate groups now, we don't really speak to each other anymore. I don't believe that. And I don't trust the Pleiadian agenda for this planet at all. I really don't. The idea that because someone comes from a different system makes them filled with light and wonderment, no, that's not true. You have to ask, what are they doing here and what is their interest? What do they want? And how much of their technology are they selling to the government in exchange for what? And indeed, are the Pleiadians themselves, because they're the ones with all the little ships flying about, the same as the Germans have, they both have the same ships, are they the ones who are doing most of the abducting, most of the things that have gone on in a negative way with this planet? And as far as the extraterrestrial aspect of it is concerned, let's remember that even in the Middle Ages, Leonardo da Vinci has drawings of their particular type of spaceship in his paintings. He's got two of them, I think, or more, in The Last Supper, and even has the Seven Sisters stars painted in there. This is Leonardo da Vinci. Where did he get all his ideas from? He clearly understood about the extraterrestrials and UFOs. So this is a long history. And the Pleiadians have this really ancient history of connecting with Earth humans who happen to be clairvoyantly gifted. They talk to the clairvoyants, they give them, and every now and then they pick one out. They clearly picked out Leonardo da Vinci and explained to him all about flying technology. I mean, that's not magic. It doesn't come out of nowhere. Somebody discusses the idea and you produce something like Da Vinci did with all his drawings of submarines and ships and flying vehicles. Now, all these hundreds and hundreds of years later, you've got Maria Orsic, who is an East European psychic, talking to these same Pleiadians and getting a whole new bunch of information about flying rockets and bombs and ships. So this is a complex thing, and I hope that Dr. Greer brings it to light and makes it clear for everybody on this planet that there are two separate, quite separate things going on. One is the politics of this planet, which is being influenced by some extraterrestrials. And the other thing that's going on is the action of extraterrestrials themselves on this planet. Two different roads, two different ways of going. I think we need to know about both of them if we are ever to choose which way we as a human species, Earth people, want to go. We have to have all the information before we can choose sides. Let's put it that way. You have to take sides and you have to choose. And it's easy to say, well, I choose the good guys, not the bad guys. You know, we're all going to choose the good if we can. But first we have to have the information to know which is good and which is not good. And right now we don't have that information because the government hides it all.
All right.
The essential things that we need to know.
Okay. So we have the Greys, the Palladians, we have the Reptilians, we have the Nordics, we have, it keeps going so many species here from different parts of the universe, right?
Essentially the Nordics are Palladians. The ones we think of as the Nordics, the pale blondes, they're the Palladians.
All right, but how about the Reptilians who can shapeshift?
The Reptilians are a different species. They're not part of the human galactic family at all. The reptilians are different creatures. They're different. They're a vast, highly intelligent, space-faring species, but they are, generally speaking, bad news for humans because they are not human. They're reptilian. All the Nordics, the Greys, the Pleiadians, the Anunnaki, all these are part of the human family, you might say, whereas the reptilians are something quite different and dangerous, very
okay.
dangerous
right.
and powerful.
You know, it's a lot of information out there. Come on. I mean, I got about 50 books here on different species and aliens and movements, and I got the UFO encyclopedia that people need to get. I got this other book down here that I was just listening to, Dark Fleet, The Secret Nazi Space Program and the Battle for the Solar System by Lynn Katzen. So I'm just saying it goes on and on and on. And
right.
many of us, when you look at 100% of the people here on planet Earth, 9 billion of us, that about 80%, they don't know anything about what we're talking about. They think we're talking about something made up. Would you believe that?
Yes, I would believe that. I mean, when you think of it like this, I would say that on these matters, I'm fairly tuned in. I mean, I've been a clairvoyant all my life. I've had extraterrestrial contact all my life. I know an ancient history, my own history. I remember tens of thousands of years of human history. So I would say that on these particular matters, I'm fairly well up on it. And yet, I had no idea of everything that was going on Mars or with the space program that the military has. I didn't know a thing about it. So if someone who has been immersed in it all their life has so many big empty patches, it's not surprising that 80% of the global population know nothing at all about it. Why would
yeah.
they? You know, why, if it's not their area of interest, why would they? And when they
okay.
do hear about it, I can quite believe that they think it's crazy. I mean, when my
okay.
mother was alive, I remember her saying they would never get to the moon in her lifetime. Well, she died young as it happened, but still, how silly that seems now when we recognize the moon as, you know, just a hop, skip, and a jump away. But how many people actually know that we have a moon base?
Well, the moon is
now,
not a planet.
We've had
The moon is not a planet,
well,
right?
Well,
it's an observatory.
It's a big lump of rock used as an observatory.
Okay. What is that? What was that comment?
It's a big lump of rock. It's a big lump of rock used as an observatory.
Okay.
George always used to say it was man-made, but I don't. Yeah.
Listen to this lady who says she was abducted and taken to the moon.
Niara Terrella Isley, who worked as a radar tracking officer, said she was snatched by a humanoid with a tail and taken to a secret base on the far side of the moon. While there, she said she was made to have sex with aliens and lift boxes. Ms. Isley told how she worked at the Tonopah Test Range in Nevada, but said she could recall very little detail about her time there. She claimed security guards raped her in front of an audience after she was jabbed in the neck with a mystery drug while in an underground lair. And then she was raped on the moon, she said. Ms. Isley described the bizarre and shocking series of incidents under hypnosis. In taped interviews with Aquarian Radio, she claimed she was taken into space 8 to 10 times over several months when she was 25 years old. She said the aliens put her to work, having her operate electronic machinery to excavate the darkest parts of the moon. Describing how she was used for sex almost every night she was on the moon, she said she was regularly passed between the reptilians. In addition, she said gray aliens were present, helping with the work, as well as human personnel who were also forced to help the reptilians do their bidding on the moon. After the abductions, she said she couldn't remember much of what had happened, including aspects of her work, leading her to think her memory had been wiped. The incident stopped in 1980, she said. She sought hypnosis in an attempt to fill the holes in her memory, and it helped her uncover more details about the abuse she experienced on the moon. Describing her abductor, she said, he was humanoid and did have a tail. She said he had yellow eyes with vertical slit pupils. On the dark side of the moon, she said, there was a lot of sexual abuse. She also said there was excavation work to expand the military base. It was then that she had to carry out manual labor, including moving boxes. Ms. Isley, a mum of one who now lives in Colorado, said, at night I wasn't allowed to sleep and was passed around for more sex. I was scared. I knew I had to get back to my daughter, so I was pretty compliant. I just didn't want to do anything that would get me killed. Many alien conspiracy theories suggest that the U.S. government is in on abductions, often helping the Greys do the work. Theorists claim that is why officials have not fully investigated claims of their own employees and former staff.
So, I mean, listen, there's so much information out there now. William Tompkins talked about the slavery, not only underground here, but even on the moon, even on Mars. How do you comment? Why is all that continuing, if I may?
Why is all the abduction continuing? Is that what you're asking me?
Yeah, why slavery? Why? I mean, this is crazy. It's all over the place. It seems to be all over the universe. Why?
Well, you know, somebody, and I'm not ascribing to this by any means, but somebody said once a long time ago, life's cheap, right?
Okay.
How are you going to get the work done without people? If you don't think that I approve of this, not at all, but if you are one of the bad guys, and a lot of them, I understand one of the biggest investors in the mining that's apparently going on Mars are the Clinton family, right? That it's the Clintons' money source. Now, if you are one of that family who are making millions and millions of dollars out of an enterprise on Mars, but in order to run that enterprise, you need labor, and some evil person comes along and says, well, I have the ability to snatch them 500 at a time from some third world country or some rural area where nobody will miss them. So if I just provide them to you, you know, will you pay me a big fee and I'll drop them off at your mining concession and you can use them? You're going to use them. You evil people will always use slave labor, always,
okay,
because that's how they make money. And no matter where it is in the universe, not just on Earth, but in the universe, money is power. And power is what the bad people always want. And so
True.
They will never care how they get it. And so long as they are getting fed the opportunity to take slave labor from this planet, now I understand, according to these books that I've read, which is shocking to me, is that now there are other species in the universe who appreciate the high level of dexterity and intelligence of humans, and now they're not just taking poor third world uneducated people and turning them into slaves. They're now taking highly educated scientists, mathematicians, doctors, astronomers, astrophysicists. They're snatching them because they are apparently able to sell those kind of people to other species, not just use them in, you know, Earth's own mines on the asteroid belt or on Mars, but sell them to distant, distant races of beings who want their intelligence, who want what they are capable of doing. It's astounding,
wow.
But humans have apparently become a high-priced commodity in the universe.
Wow, wow.
And one of the things that we haven't mentioned at all today, and that's fine too, but I'm thinking probably one of the reasons that Earth humans have become such a high-priced commodity is because they have evolving souls, and it's very possible that there are other species out there in the universe who are soulless beings, pure biological entities, or who are beings who have lost their soul energy through all their own ill deeds and are no longer producing ensouled beings. They are just biological entities, beings without souls. And this is something which really exists. It exists on our planet. Even the native people on this planet, the Native Americans on this planet, recognize that. They call them non-people, the non-people. And these are people who are pure and simple biological entities, the result of a natural reproductive thing, but never, ever embodied a soul. They're soulless beings. So you do find a few on this planet. But maybe for all we know, there are many of them out there in the universe, and this is why they want humans, because most humans have souls.
So what would they do with
their
soul? That's
what makes it very different.
What would they do with the soul?
Well, it isn't what they would do with the soul. It's the fact that a human being has a soul. Having a soul gives you so many gifts of itself, so much potential, so much, because it's the source of your creativity. It's out of your soul energy that you become creative, and you become a creative thinker or a painter or a doctor or whatever it is that you do creatively that sustains life. That energy, that driving force to do that is your soul's energy.
Ah. So
this is where creativity comes from. And this is the great thing that matters when we look at all this, you know, the abductions, the terrible things, the ETs, doesn't matter. So the most important thing of everything else is your soul. Way beyond anything else that ever happens to you is what you do with your soul.
Okay. You were saying that there are other entities out there on some different Andromeda, wherever, out there on the Pleiades, or Pleiades, there happen to be many different planets out there, who may be born without souls or created without souls.
Right.
Is that right?
Yes.
So
yes.
Go ahead.
The divine spark of life comes from the source, the one, the creator, right?
Right.
And
right.
Everything in nature, the flowers in the garden, the leaves on the tree, the cat sitting in the window, everything in nature has that divine spark of life in it. Would you agree with that?
Yes, okay, yes.
If it's alive, it has the divine spark. Right. Now, an ensouled being, an Earth human, for example, has that divine spark, but it also has the ability to embody, that physical body has the ability to house a soul. That soul energy wraps around the divine spark and becomes that person.
Okay.
The soul is so much more than just the divine spark. The divine spark is the spark of life that's in everything. The soul is the energy that you were never a soul before. There was no soul there whatsoever. And the moment that the divine spark is given to you as an infant, right, then a soul begins to develop around that divine spark. Or let's say that you're in your 50th reincarnation. So you've got a soul that's had 50 incarnations, and there in front of you is a new baby body with the divine spark of life in it. It's going to be a living person. And you as a soul and of light, a being of light, come into that body and wrap around that divine spark and enhance it and use that energy in that body to advance your soul. That's because you're an ensouled being. Not everybody has that. There, it is perfectly possible. And in fact, I think that we even mentioned some of this one time when you, I believe it was you, talked to me briefly once about some babies in an experiment. They birthed 7 or 8 infants in outside the uterus. They developed them in tanks of some kind.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
You know, well, those babies did not have souls. They were soulless. They were simply laboratory-produced entities, biological entities. And when they talk about some of the ETs, like the ones from Roswell, they called them, the government called them EBE, extraterrestial biological entities.
Without
the
a soul.
EBs, right?
Without a soul.
And these are presumed soulless beings, just biological entities.
Okay.
Different,
when does this,
right?
Okay. For people born on this planet, all the 9 billion people born on this planet have a soul, yes or no? More than like.
Hopefully.
Yes?
Hopefully.
Okay. Wait a minute.
99.9%.
So, you're a nurse. And I want to talk about this just for a couple of minutes, and then we can, you know, close it out for the day. But, for instance, the decision was made by the Supreme Court, Roe versus Wade.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Mm-hmm. So they say to the masses of human beings, stop abortions, because abortions are evil, despicable, diabolical, nefarious. Right? Right? Is that what
so that's what they're saying, yes.
That's what they're saying, okay. So when a child is conceived at that moment of conception, is the soul there?
No.
No?
Absolutely not.
When does the soul come in? Okay, help us out.
Okay.
When does, you are a nurse. When does the soul come in?
Imagine it this way. Imagine that you are a soul waiting for a body, right?
Uh-huh.
And so a nice man and a woman with a nice home and offering the potential environment for what you as a soul know you need for your next learning experience on this planet, they get together and they conceive an infant. Now, you're back in heaven or wherever you are, right? And your counselors say to you, look, there's a potential human body for you conceived. Would you be interested in that body? And you say, yes, I'd jump at the chance. It looks perfect for me and for what
right.
I need to learn. So you keep a watch on that progress of that infant. Is it going to actually develop? Are the cells going to divide? Are there going to be no problems? You definitely have decided that you're not into, you know, using an unhealthy body. You want a healthy body for this particular incarnation. So you watch what's happening with that pregnancy. And then somewhere about the 12th to the 16th week, in that period of time, you start going into that body to try it on for size. And the first time you go into it, the body twitches. And they call that, they used to call it the quickening. And it's the moment when the child moves in the womb, the first time it moves. That is the soul energy going into that body for the first time. Now, from that point on, the soul goes in and out of that body right up until immediately prior to birth, and then it takes full-time residence, and then the baby is born. Once it takes full-time residence, it's getting time for that baby to be born. So in the first 3 months of pregnancy, from a spiritual perspective, there is no moral reason to not have an abortion if it is deemed necessary for whatever reason the mother or the parents decide is necessary. You know, it could be a million reasons, but there is, from spirit's point of view, there is no moral judgment against anyone who has an abortion in that first 3 months. Now, there might be moral judgment against the mother because she keeps having indiscriminate sex and keeps having abortions one after another. Well, you know, she's going to have to answer for that one day. But let us assume that the abortion is for some real reason that makes it necessary and desirable for everyone concerned. Then there is no moral judgment on it. Once you get the soul inhabiting the body, once that baby has quickened, that's a whole different issue. Then you are taking a life.
I see.
And so in those circumstances, it really has to be that somebody's life is in danger if an abortion is to take place. There can be no other reason. I mean, if it's a case of the mother's life, for instance, and that husband and wife have three kids at home, and the husband says, I agree with you, wife. I think you should have a termination, because who's going to look after the three children at home if this delivery kills you? You know, if it's some condition where the mother's life is at risk, yes, then there are exceptions to every rule. But as a general rule, first 12 weeks, abortion, spiritually speaking, okay. After that, not so okay.
All right. So given the fact that you explained it in that fashion, what is your take on Roe versus Wade, the Supreme Court?
Well, I think it was too I think it was too broad. I think, and though I don't think it should have been overturned, leaving many women now in limbo until something else is decided, I do think that it should have been reviewed and probably rewritten or totally amended, because, for instance, I don't think that a 18-year-old girl should be going and getting abortions without her mother's knowledge, or at least a responsible adult counseling her and guiding her. There should be some oversight on abortions. I don't think you should just be able to walk off the street and get them willy-nilly at any age and for any reason that you feel like it. But that's just my view. You know, I'm not in favor of indiscriminate sex. I think that's what we have to tackle, is the indiscriminate use of sex, which produces the need for all these abortions. You know, if we didn't have the indiscriminate sex, we wouldn't have all the abortions. We wouldn't have the need for them. But I also think we need rules, new rules and regulations, which need to be federal. I agree mostly with states deciding things. But when, for instance, Texas has immediately announced that in the great state of Texas, which is a place I happen to love dearly, they have now said if you're more than 6 weeks pregnant, you can't have an abortion or use the night after pill or any of these things. Well, that's ridiculous, because to be 100% certain that a woman is pregnant, and most of them wouldn't even know in only 6 weeks, let alone have time to make a doctor's appointment and go and get the abortions within that 6 weeks. So that's a ridiculous thing to me. My personal opinion is that's not going to help anybody. It's just going to make life very difficult. So I think this is an issue. First, I think it should be decided by women, not men. I don't think that the government, where it's predominantly male government, male decision making, should have anything to do with it. These are women's bodies, and the women should be the ones to decide. And I don't think it should either be decided by one faction or the other faction, because it has, ultimately, it has to be an individual's choice whether to go ahead with an abortion. And therefore, the rules that regulate abortions and abortion clinics and doctors and facilities, these need to be accommodating to all points of view. Everybody needs to be able to have their say, and new rules need to be written which are fair and just, and not pushing in the face of women because of dead babies, and not allowing the pharmaceutical industry to have access to the fetuses that are aborted, which I think is an abomination, right? We need to review the whole thing, because the reality is abortions have gone on from time immemorial. Now, I don't have children of my own, and therefore I could never imagine a situation where, had I been fortunate enough to have a child, I would have thought about aborting it. I can't imagine that. But I can imagine the agonies that women must go through who have real need for abortions, or who've had them for even less, more frivolous reasons, and then think back on it and think about what they did to themselves and their bodies. So in general, I'm in favor of supporting the infant with the mother. But first, I'm supporting the potential mother. I think we need new rules, and I think they need to be worked out by women, not men. That's just okay. My personal opinion.
Okay. How, with Bill Gates and a bunch of his friends who are practicing eugenics, is this good or bad for them, the decision?
Is that decision good or bad for them? I should think that it will be good for them, because you're getting places like Texas, which is going to mean that we are going to have more unwanted children. And where is those unwanted children going to go? They're going to end up in the hands of so-called philanthropic societies like Bill Gates, and who knows what happens to them from there. There are horrific stories already about children being taken for nefarious reasons. Children are going missing all the time. And we don't know what happens to them.
You think some of them are sent to Mars and other planets to go to work?
It's quite possible. I don't know that. I don't know. But right now, there is so much truth coming out. And it is so amazing to me that all these things have been happening under our noses for years and years, and we didn't even know about it. I'm not very tolerant of most things, and I'll say, how could somebody be so stupid as to do that? Well, when I'm looking at these things that I'm reading about now that are coming from sound, solid, respectable, well-researched sources like Dr. Michael Soller's books, and I ask myself, how could I have been so stupid and not known that this was going on? How can we not know so much? How can we all be so ignorant?
But it's not in the media. It's not on ABC, CBS, NBC about these aliens or Pleiades and coming from an Andromeda. It's not about the Anarchy. They don't talk about the reptilians
who
shapeshift.
We all know the mainstream. Yeah. Mainstream media, never reliable.
Besides, I love Lucy, Gilligan's Islands.
I think they must be your favorite shows. You've mentioned them so many times. I think you must love them.
May I say I have watched them?
When are we off to Gilligan's Island, Russell? That's what I'd like to know.
Okay, but here's the point. The point being, they did discuss these issues on those programs. Did you know that?
Yes. Yes.
Okay, so how do you get that information?
You know, if you really want to understand a lot of what has gone on, you should watch Star Trek.
Okay.
And now they are actually on some TV channels, they are rerunning the original Captain Kirk Star Trek. I just saw something the other day on my Roku, and it said something about some channel had Star Trek on. Right, and I thought, oh, I must find that. I must find it and watch it all again, because there are some amazing stories there. And as I'm sure you know, one of the leading engineers, leading producers, directors of Star Trek, was friends with the son of the Air Force general who was the government person for all this to do with the development of the engines and technologies for the UFOs. And this general would be instructed by the government which pieces of information to feed to his son, supposedly top secret information, but he was told to feed it to his son. And his son's job was to feed it then to the director or producer, of the Star Trek. You know who I'm talking about, who did Gene Roddenberry, right? Who did Star Trek. And so the information that formed a background to the Star Trek stories came from the top secret government UFO research. That's where it came from.
Okay.
And that's all written about in Dr. Sala's books.
Okay, okay.
He tells that whole story. So you're going to find out a lot of the stuff about extraterrestrial species, ones that the government knew about because they are built into the Star Trek stories and characters. Think about, Spock. How come the Vulcans and Spock and that whole Star Trek is a lot more than it seems. It's science fiction, but science.
All right. Well, listen, we've covered a lot of territory. And what would you recommend people to do to further get information about what's really going on planet Earth and in the four corners of the universe? There's Gaia, there's Cosmic Connections, there's Ancient Aliens, there's Beyond Belief by George Noway. I mean, would you tell people to do some homework about what's going on?
Yes, absolutely. You know, that Ancient Aliens program on the History Channel, I don't watch it, but the lady who helps me in the house, she and her husband watch it all the time, and she comes asking me questions about this stuff, and I haven't even seen the program. But it's apparently a most excellent program, and one that's well worth watching. And there are many. If you don't like to read, there are many. The Van Daniken books are now on the TV programs, the Chariots of the Gods. There are programs about ancient Egypt and Sumeria, the Sumerian program. There's an excellent one out there now called Noah. The biblical Noah and the flood. Well, it's a four-part series on the History Channel called Noah. And that's interesting for those who are bibliophiles. They have, in this series, they started out with the story of Noah, and then they have used the Bible itself to find a timeline through history, right up to the modern times, right up to the present day, about human history. And that's a very interesting program to watch because it's right on the mark when it comes to timing.
Okay, great, great, great.
You know, what we can expect and when we can expect. So there's plenty to watch on TV. There are great books out there. And if you just like a book that's easy reading and fun reading, but explains so many things, by all means, all Dr. Sala's books, but and his website. He has a website as well. But
okay.
Also, David Icke. Do you remember David Icke?
Of course I do.
Well, David's books are very interesting and well worth reading.
Well, he's from the UK, isn't he?
Lots of information. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes,
I believe
he lives on the Isle of Wight.
Yeah.
But lots and lots of good information in his books. I don't agree with it all. I don't agree with all, you know, I mean, there's stuff like David Icke wrote that I didn't agree with at all. But I'm just one person with an opinion. All you're getting from me is what I know and my opinion, right? But everybody has a different point of view or different things resonate with different people. I would highly recommend reading David Icke's books.
Right, right.
And
then he has a channel now on Gaia. He has a channel on Gaia with a lot of...
Does he?
I've been watching.
I know David,
I've been watching him lately. He's very articulate. Yeah.
Well, he is. And he's very knowledgeable and he's very smart. He's a very smart man, is David Icke. So there's lots to read out there.
All right.
You know,
well, listen.
If you...
Go ahead. Go ahead. If
I was going to say it doesn't hurt either to just catch up on history on this planet. And if you are like me, when I was in school, I hated history because it was all learning dates and things. But if you go on the television and learn your history from, like, the British history on the Royalty Channel or history in general, European history, read books about famous people in history. Catherine the Great of Russia will give you a whole different view of European history. And she's a magnificent woman, and it's a great story. You know, her biography is a phenomenal book to read. I've read it several times, and I never get tired of it because it's such a good story. So read about history, but read it in a way that you enjoy the reading, not like a punishment. What does its spirit say? Do everything you do for the joy of doing it without attachment to the outcome. In other words, read history for the pleasure of reading it, and it doesn't matter if you remember any of the dates or not. That's quite irrelevant. Just read the story.
All right, well, we've come to the end of the hour. Thank you very much. I really appreciate you being here. And we will talk about David Icke and some other, and Eisenhower and why JFK had to leave and all of that next time. How's that? Okay?
Okay, wonderful. Thanks for having me, Russell. You know I enjoy it.
Well,
bye
thank
now.
You very much. I appreciate it. You have a great day, and a great weekend. Thank you now.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye now.